Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have the opportunity to discuss several aspects of it, especially several that are prominently in Washington's focus at this juncture, with one of the country's foremost national security reporters, a man who we touch base with from time to time to get his sense of what's going on, and this is a very important moment to do that. He is Rowan Scarborough, a national security reporter and veteran of the Washington Times. He is the author of Rumsfeld's War and Sabotage, America's Enemies Within the CIA. Rowan Scarborough, welcome back. It is so good to have you.
Good to talk to you, Frank.
Well, you've been reporting on various aspects of this story for some time, of course, Rowan, including a series of reports on aspects of it that haven't gotten much attention, and we'll come back to that in a moment. But I did want to ask you, first of all, for your reaction, your take on what was unveiled yesterday in the way of indictments of three individuals associated with the Trump campaign by Robert Mueller.
Frank, I thought one of the most significant events yesterday was that John Podesta's brother resigned as head of the Podesta Group, and that he is essentially confirming that Mueller has made him and his company a target of that probe. So this probe is more than just looking at Trump people. They're now also looking at the Democratic swamp that sucks in lots of money from lots of foreign clients and then goes around town lobbying for them. So I thought that was a really big deal, because it tells me that we know what the other shoe is that needs to drop, and that is how this dossier was funded. And we now know it was funded with Hillary Clinton money going overseas to pay Russians. And if Mueller is willing to look into the Podesta Group, I think that shows that he would be willing to look into how this dossier was funded with campaign money, which on its face to me seems to be very, very iffy, whether you can take campaign money and start paying foreign agents for their work or for their information.
To say nothing of foreign Russian agents at that, who seem to be at least one of the sources of this so-called dodgy dossier. But let me come back to that, if I may, Warren, just very quickly before we turn to it. Were you surprised by anything that was contained in the indictments, the guilty plea, for that matter, of this fellow George Papadopoulos? Was that a revelation, and do you think that's the last we've heard of that?
Well, right. We knew Manafort was going to be indicted. George Papadopoulos, whose name surfaced a few times because Trump turned all their campaign emails over to Congress, and then some Democratic staffers leaked some of the contents to the Washington Post, in which Papadopoulos was urging meetings with Russians to facilitate Trump's goal to have better ties with Putin, which we can all question. It was surprising that Mueller put that guilty plea out along with Manafort. I think it was a signal from Mueller that, hey, there may not be anything about the Russian probe in the Manafort indictment, but we are looking at the Russian probe. And in the filings made clear that Mr. Papadopoulos has been cooperating with Mueller since at least July. And again, you know, his legal staff writes these things up. I mean, so they have why are they putting that in? And I think his prosecutors, many of them Clinton donors, Democratic donors, are sending a message to Trump people that this guy is talking to us.
Right. And there may be other, to use your metaphor, shoes to drop on that score as well. Let me come back, though, to the larger point you've made, and you've done some wonderful reporting on this, Rowan Scarborough, at the Washington Times, about other aspects besides this dossier of Hillary Clinton's collusion with Russia. I think there's just really no other way to describe it, whether it's the Uranium One deal, her husband's very high pay-to-play speech making there. This business of Skolkovo, which has, to my astonishment, not gotten any attention really to speak of at all, namely an effort by the Clinton State Department, the Obama administration more generally, but specifically Hillary Clinton State Department, to facilitate the establishment of a Silicon Valley in the outskirts of Moscow, a town called Skolkovo, which involved a lot of transfers of militarily relevant technology, as you know, Ron. Are those likely to get attention from this special prosecutor? And can they really, since his conduct in the course of an investigation by the FBI of some of that would seem to be a decided conflict of interest? How do you see that playing out?
Well, I think, first of all, if Mueller wanted to start looking into the uranium deal, he would have to go back to Deputy AG Rosenstein, because I'm sure that when those two people sat down to go over the scope of the investigation, Uranium One was not part of Russian interference in the 2016 election. So I think Mueller would have to, if he was so inclined. But what Uranium One shows us is that there was a pattern of Hillary State Department doing favors for Russia, and then people associated with Putin doing favors for her, i.e. money. I mean, over $100 million flowed into the Clinton Foundation from people connected to the uranium deal on the Russian side. And at the same time, she's trying to get Silicon Valley to help Putin build his own sort of cyber city outside of Moscow. I mean, that's a big, the phrase is quid pro quo. That on its face is quid pro quo. Now, whether the Justice Department wants to try to make a bribery investigation out of that, as they did in the Virginia governor case with McDonald, I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But Mueller, to me, Frank, would have to go seek permission to do that. And I don't think his guys would want to do that, frankly.
I don't think they want to do it. And I think they would be conflicted out if they tried. Let me turn to one other thing. You've been following very closely in your excellent reporting on what's going on in the Pentagon, Rowan Scarborough, about this issue of transgenders being allowed to serve. President Trump has indicated that he doesn't think they should. A federal judge yesterday, as you know, countermanded him and said at least those that are currently serving will be allowed to continue to do so. A rather brazen example of judicial overreach, it seems to me, particularly with respect to the commander-in-chief's authorities. What do you make of this, Rowan? Is there a problem here? Or is the judge on sound footing to just tell the president what to do with respect to the United States military?
Well, you know, the courts have traditionally given wide leeway for the military to regulate Congress and the military to regulate troops. It's in the Constitution that it's Congress's duty to regulate the military, and it's the president's duty to command them. But these days, we have a judge in Hawaii, a district court judge, trying to dictate immigration policy for the nation. So times have certainly changed. So like that case, I think this is a case where in the end, an appeals court is going to have to get involved, and then maybe the Supreme Court. I think the way Mattis would like to go, this is my opinion, is that we would just stay with the current troops who are transgender could remain in, but we would not take that next step, which was supposed to happen earlier this year, and that is to begin recruiting transgender people into the military. It seems to me that is the compromise that they're headed for within the administration. And then the courts, it's going to be challenged by activist groups. And that to me will be the final determination. But presidents and Congress should be given leeway to decide what is best for the readiness of the force. And that's what higher courts have traditionally done.
Right. And it seems in this case, the military has pretty clearly indicated that they have real problems with the impact on readiness and preparedness of the troops if this goes forward. Rowan Scarborough will be watching it closely, as I know will you. I'm hopeful that in the end, the courts will reassert the standard practice and give the president the discretion that he's needing in this case, among others. Keep up the good work, my friend, at the Washington Times. Thank you for visiting with us, and I hope you'll do so again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman. We'll talk with him about economic warfare developments of importance to you. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we have with us Kevin Freeman for our weekly visit with the senior fellow on global economic warfare for the Center for Security Policy. He is the founder and the driving force behind a terrific online resource, globaleconomicwarfare.com, and the author of two must-read, best-selling books. The first is Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, and Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. And we want to talk to him a bit about cyber and cyber economic attacks, but first let me do a proper welcome. Kevin, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
I did want to just pick up on something we were discussing a moment ago with Rowan Scarborough, Kevin, just to get your sense of the lay of the land with respect to these indictments and what you make of them.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, hidden in the indictments are things like Paul Manafort misled the bankers that were loaning him money, and the indictments all seem very surface and away from the whole Russian collusion narrative. I suppose that's what you do when you're trying to ensnare someone, that you get them on something you can get solidly, and then you try and twist it to where you can get at the present. But from my first read, it looked like these were all activities that were away from the Russian collusion story and really not directly applied. So I suppose they're going to use prosecutorial pressure to get where they want to go.
Well, of course, the guy who copped a plea, George Papadopoulos, is a little closer to the campaign on this account of Russian involvement. But I think you're right, as we talked about with Rowan, there's a lot of shoes yet to drop on this front, to say nothing of the exploration of other and arguably much more ominous instances of collusion with the Russians to the detriment of the national security. Kevin, tell me what you make of President Trump and the visit he's likely to pay to China at a most interesting time, specifically in the aftermath of Xi Jinping's consolidation of power, but with a certain amount of economic turmoil taking place in the People's Republic.
Well, there's no question. There's the economic turmoil. The Manufacturing Purchases Managers Index that was released slipped again in October. We're seeing a slowing in China, and that's having direct repercussions. We had a bond default by Dandong Port Company. They failed to pay part of their note back just yesterday. And so we're beginning to see all of this debt that's built up in China. They've built their miracle of growth on debt. And it's beginning to slow. So they are becoming, I would think, a little more desperate economically. And so the timing is, it could be very good for the president, as we just had a 3% plus, 3.1% economic growth rate happening. So it will be very interesting. These are good times to address these issues.
Well, these issues, and of course, the issue that I think is overarching for the president, and that is inducing the Chinese to see it as no longer in their interest to prop up the regime of the latest Kim dictator, Kim Jong-un, in North Korea. Do you see any sign that there may be progress on that front, Kevin Freeman?
We certainly are positioned to do it because the Chinese economy has slowed. They have not reduced their exports to North Korea, but there is evidence that President Xi is frustrated with North Korea and how they've reacted. And then we see the collapse in the mountain where 200 people were killed because of their nuclear testing. So hopefully the timing is good, and hopefully the president can make progress and say that it's not in China's interest. And if you want to be a part of the global economic community, you have to withdraw support from North Korea.
Indeed. And by so doing, hopefully bring about the one solution to this problem that seems to me is remotely possible at the moment, and that is regime change instigated by the Chinese. And we'll be watching that closely, as I know will you. Hey, Kevin, speaking of cyber economic attack, there was an interesting report just the other day about the people who are said to have been responsible for hacking in our elections last year are at it again, apparently using, of all things, some cyber warfare conference called CyCon in Washington, D.C., which will gather a large number of people involved in trying to protect the United States and the West more generally against cyber attacks. And they apparently turned it into an opportunity to actually do some cyber attacking against these defenders. Talk a little bit about that and again, how acute our problems are in this space, Kevin.
It points out multiple problems in the space. One is the Russians are busily watching every conference that we have. They're in Washington. They're watching people go in and out of buildings. They have a spy network. They're watching the email traffic. And what they did here is they took an email that was legitimate for CyCon, which is a big international cyber conference that we have, and they spoofed that email with a Word document that had the exact everything, logo and everything else looked identical, but hidden in that as Microsoft Word document was a macro that enabled them to install software on the computer, malicious software that would allow them to take over the computer. And the people that perpetrated this, it appears to be Fancy Bear, which is the same group of Russians that have attacked and hacked multiple other things, including possibly they're the ones blamed for the DNC hack and so forth. So it's a very sophisticated hacking group. They were targeting high-end officials and people attending this conference. The very people that should be defending us from cyber attacks were being the ones compromised, which is the same inside-the-wire argument that I've been making in regard to Kaspersky and others, that they're looking at our security and they're trying to exploit our security to gain a foothold.
It just boggles the mind that we allowed any government entity to utilize Kaspersky software, knowing their associations with the Kremlin and the likelihood that they would be used for, economic and cyber warfare against us. Kevin, we participated in a conference last week of a different kind, the Asymmetric Threat Conference. And while the rules of the conference preclude direct attribution, I'd be very interested in your takeaway about the emphasis placed by a number of senior military officers and others on some of these asymmetric threats, including, not least, cyber attack.
Well, it was an amazing conference, and I appreciate you're the one that got the invitation for me. And Center for Security Policy was a co-sponsor of the event. And on the panels that sat before us, you were one of the moderators, but the various panels, I counted 36 stars on the shoulders of admirals and generals. And one conclusion, well, I took away a number of conclusions. The first one was we're already in a war. It's not a declared war. It's not a normal war, but we're in a war now. And the second conclusion I took away, it's basically an economic war. Whether it's economic to destroy our economy so that we can't field a strong fighting force, we can't modernize our air force, we can't modernize our navy, we can't keep the number of ships at sea that we need or should have. It's a cyber war in that quantum computing and artificial intelligence are all a big part. And they talked about things being inside the wire like Kaspersky Labs and the DJI drones from China and how those are potentially compromised. And they said it's not a messaging problem, it's a reality problem. And they said, how can we ever win if we never admit that the bad guys are the bad guys?
Well, there's a key point at the very beginning. Very, very key point. And an excellent summary, Kevin Freeman, of the Asymmetric Threat Symposium. There will be a summary of that conference, for those of you who missed it, available shortly. And Kevin, I appreciated very much you being there, as it was a pleasure to be a co-sponsor of it myself. Thank you so much for joining us today, Kevin. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Matt Brodsky joins us next. We'll talk about the Iran deal and the hegemony of the Middle East that Iran now increasingly is exercising, in part as a result of it. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Matthew Brodsky. He is a very active contributor to what I think of as the national security policy debate in his role as a senior Middle East analyst at Wikistrat. He has in the past been involved with the Jewish Policy Center, the American Foreign Policy Council, Haaretz, and more. We are delighted whenever we get a chance to pick his brains about developments in his area of expertise, the Middle East. And this is one of those occasions. Matt Brodsky, welcome back. It is so good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
You've recently written a piece, Matt, that I thought was most interesting about the debate that has taken place, or not, as the case may be, about the president's decision to not certify that Iran is in compliance with the what I think of as the Obama bomb deal, and that it's in our interest, two rather important, you know, qualities of the deal. You note that there's been a lot of discussion in the sort of right on this, but not so much in the circles on the left. Tell us a little bit about your current thinking about the deal, what the president has done, and why is it that we're not seeing a similar kind of conversation taking place on the left about the merits of the Obama bomb deal and where we go from here?
Well, for a while, there has been a debate that we've known about on the right, and that's been between those who wanted to walk away from the deal and those that wanted to fix the deal. President Trump, I believe, made the right move by decertifying the nuclear agreement, and whether the path to try to fix it and tighten up the key areas that are missing, such as verifications, the ballistic missiles program, and the sunset clauses, which just need to be scrapped to begin with, whether that can come to pass, we'll see in the future. But that debate on the right has more or less taken place, and the president is going along the path to fix it. And there have been a number of developments in that area. On the left, however, it's a lot more of a convoluted process that took place to get the deal passed to begin with under Obama. And there hasn't been a debate. There's been the regurgitation of stale talking points, which at this point are verifiably false, even if the agreement itself is not verifiable. And so you've had the creation of an echo chamber to begin with, this vanguard, a group that saw in Iran the desire for the United States basically to strategically reorient ourselves and to boost Iran in the region as we withdrew. And Iran was seen as a far more capable and cohesive group than the Sunni governments that we were working with in the Middle East. So it would be better if they were to inherit the Middle East as we withdrew. And so what happened was they created the echo chamber that we all know about by now from Ben Rhodes, and newly minted experts who began popping up at think tanks and saying that they, basically wholesale lying about what was going to be in the agreement and what the agreement meant and on a whole set of issues. They have not really updated these talking points at this point. They created a large camp of believers. So in the meantime, there hasn't been on the left a great desire to work with those on the right who want to fix the deal, because they're still stuck believing all these stale talking points that are still going on inside their head, even though, again, they're verifiably wrong.
Matt, could I put it slightly differently? It sounds to me as though what you've described is we were hustled into believing that there was a deal here that was worth a damn. And the people who perpetrated that, Ben Rhodes, the Obama team more generally, and the Plowshares Fund, and as you say, the whole echo chamber that these guys conjured up, the NIAC, the North American Iranian Council, and the like, perpetrated a fraud. And they're reluctant to acknowledge that they did, even though, as you say, it's proven to be demonstrably so. I must tell you, I'm with the Nixit group rather than the Fixit group. I don't think there's going to be any fixing it. But just quickly, Matt, the administration is now talking about a very aggressive inspection regime to try to help make it less defective. I would be very interested in your thoughts as to whether that's got a snowball's chance in hell with the team in Tehran, let alone the others in the so-called Perm 5 plus 1.
Right. Well, okay. So it certainly was a good sign that that Congress sent a letter to the UN, to Nikki Haley, and that they're trying to create this much stronger verifications regime that that will look into the military sites, which is hugely important. I mean, Iran has a long history of running parallel organizations, whether it has to do with its own army and then the IRGC, whether it has to do with a Lebanese government and their army and then the Hezbollah. So they've done the same thing with a military program that works on nukes and a civilian program that works on nukes. And they can just change the signs however they'd like and avoid the inspections. That's a great sign. As far as the snowball's chance in hell is concerned, there are many opportunities for this snowball to melt. I mean, you can have the greatest inspections regime that you would like during the course of the deal, but if it still has a sunset at the end, then it doesn't matter in however many years it is on that specific item. So it is absolutely, to use a Rumsfeldian line, a long slog to get to the to where the deal could actually be fixed.
If indeed there's any will to fix it on the other part of the other parties. Hey, Matt, before we run out of time, let me quickly ask you about two related points. One is, you've been warning for some time, I think, about this Shiite crescent, the so-called land bridge between Iran and the Mediterranean that it now seems to be putting into place under pretty much its control. I'm interested in your thoughts strategically about that as a development, what it might mean for Israel, particularly as Iranians and Hezbollah and their Syrian military and other proxies are now edging closer and closer to the red lines that the Israelis have laid down. And lastly, to talk quickly, if you would, about Kurdistan and the fact that it seems to be game over for an important set of our allies in the region.
I'll take the last one first. In Kurdistan, I think they overplayed their hand, Barzani did, and especially he thought that the United States would have his back or the Kurds' back, and that didn't happen. Now you're seeing fracturing or continued fracturing along fissure lines that have long existed. The outlook for them and any form of independence looks more grim today than it did a month ago. As far as the Shiite crescent is concerned, the larger thing that I'm looking at right now with interest is how the rules of the game are changing between Israel and Hezbollah. Israel had a free rein to attack what it saw from shipments from Iran going to Hezbollah in Syria for a while, especially since 2011, the civil war in Syria. That changed in 2015 when Russia got involved, and then most of their attacks had to take place south of Homs because Iran knew that, and so did Hezbollah. They tried to keep transfers north of that line under the Russian air umbrella. Going forward, as the war wears down, you're seeing Assad become a bit more forward in the way he's willing to respond to Israel. What is the recalibration of what Israel can hit without getting a too strong of a response from either Assad, Hezbollah, or Iran before a war would erupt? That is a major concern for Israel. And the United States right now does not seem to have a large care for how that all develops. I think the United States is very much involved in Iraq policy. Many aspects of it when it comes to Iraq are boneheaded, in my opinion. But this whole Syrian policy pretty much flows from the Iraq policy and our ISIS policy and is not forward-looking on Iran. That's a problem.
Well, I couldn't agree more. In fact, I think this has been almost single-mindedly focused on the ISIS campaign and the repercussions of the vacuum of power that's been created as a result, and the fact that the Iranians are happily filling it is going to cause us problems for many, many years to come. Matt Brodsky, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for joining us. Check out more of Matt's work at his Twitter handle, at RJ Brodsky, also at Wikistrat. It's great to talk with you, sir. Next up, we'll speak with Jessica Vaughn of the Center for Immigration Studies on some of the more portentous developments on that front. Right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is with the greatest of enthusiasm that I say we are now joined by Jessica Vaughn. She is the Director of Policy Studies at an organization I consider to be simply indispensable. It is the Center for Immigration Studies. It does really cutting-edge work in helping the rest of us understand the public policy issues and the debates that are taking place about them in connection with everything from sanctuary cities to immigration reform to DACA and so much more. And we're always pleased that she's with us. She is a former Foreign Service officer, of all things, with experience, among other places, in Latin America. She is highly acclaimed in terms of her contributions to the public policy debate in this space by media all over the country and of all stripes. So it's always a delight to have her with us as well. Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be with you.
So I wanted to start with the president's efforts to try to lay out what seem to be eminently sensible principles to govern the kind of immigration that is in the, well, national security interests of the United States, as well as more broadly. What is your current understanding of the state of play with respect to those principles on Capitol Hill, Jessica?
Well, this is a very comprehensive list of priorities, ranging from border security to interior enforcement, asylum reform, and ending chain migration. And it's really a to-do list for Congress. The president can only do so much on his own. He's done a great deal already, but Congress needs to act too. And the time is ripe for it because the priority for many members of Congress right now is to enact an amnesty for the so-called Dreamers or the people with DACA. And the president, in setting out this list of priorities, is telling Congress, you know, look, we've got a lot of other bigger problems to fix. This may be the opportunity to fix some of them. What's happening now, the Democrats, who are, you know, the loudest pro-amnesty voices, of course, are saying that they want to do a bill that is just an amnesty for the Dreamers. It would actually be a perpetual amnesty for any child who makes it to the United States illegally.
And for their relatives, I believe. Is that also the case?
Yes, indeed. Parents, siblings.
So in other words, the people who are widely condemned for having brought these children illegally here are going to get rewarded for doing so along with their children.
That's important to remember. Any amnesty for the so-called Dreamers or the people with DACA, which is who it should be, if there is going to be one, is in effect an amnesty for their spouses, their parents, their siblings, and future relatives who would be sponsored by them. So it exponentially increases. For every green card given out in an amnesty, there's usually three more that result from it.
So we're talking about possibly not just the 800,000 or so that we often are told about, but maybe 3.5 million. So this is what Congress is being encouraged to do by the Democrats. Where do the Republicans come down?
Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell have each convened a working group of key Republicans, including people from leadership and people who have expertise from the Judiciary Committees, and they represented in those groups are both immigration security stalwarts like Bob Goodlatte on the House side and Senator Grassley on the Senate side, but also people who are pushing for and would be perfectly happy with a mass amnesty, people like Kevin McCarthy on the House side and Lindsey Graham on the Senate side. So Republicans right now are making a deal with each other on what to do about the Dreamers. And there's a risk here that we could end up with a very bad deal that would be praised by the likes of Senator Lindsey Graham and others for this massive amnesty and, of course, future chain migration and an offering of token border security in exchange that will be used to, you know, in the hopes of fooling average voters who want to see much more, who are not all that excited about an amnesty, but are willing to put up with it if we can get some real security and safety-minded reforms in place.
And this whole question of are they going to throw in with the Democrats is in part going to be informed, perhaps, by what's happening on the ground in terms of upcoming votes. There is, of course, a relatively small number of elections in this off year, at least at the level of governors and sort of the prominent, you know, focus of attention that they typically are. One of the races that is taking place and has increasingly had overtones of a real divide on immigration issues is, of course, here in the Washington, D.C. area in Virginia. Jessica Vaughn, talk a little bit about that race as it's shaping up and the implications, as you see them, for this congressional ongoing thrash about DACA and immigration more generally.
Well, I think there's a lot at stake in this Virginia election, and part of it is because it's taking place at this time where members of Congress are watching it and deciding what to do about immigration. And it's important because the two candidates couldn't be more different. The Republican candidate, Gillespie, is wearing the mantle of a pro-rule of law and law of order approach. He's talked a lot about the need to crack down on sanctuaries, the huge problem of MS-13 and other transnational gangs, and in general pushing very Trump-esque themes. And so the outcome of this race could have a huge impact, I think will have a huge impact on how members of Congress go into these negotiations over an amnesty bill. If Gillespie does well, that will really strengthen the hand of pro-immigration security people in Congress to do more than just give an amnesty, do more than token security, but to actually do something about these issues if they play well in Virginia, because Virginia is kind of a purple state where people don't know what's going to happen. Gillespie has correctly, in my view, made these such an issue because I think these issues resonate with voters, with regular people living their lives who are distressed about our permissive immigration policies that we had before Trump was elected.
Well, that was certainly true in 2016, wasn't it? But this Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam, Ed Gillespie's opponent, has in just the past 24 hours, I think, unleashed a campaign TV ad series on this issue, but very much playing to sort of the notion that this is all white supremacism and you know, the Charlottesville overtones and so on. So how do you think this is likely to net out, Jessica? I know perhaps we're getting beyond your expertise on immigration issues, but it does seem it's very, very high stakes indeed. In addition to the governor's race, this has a profound impact, potentially at least, on what happens in terms of a national policy on immigration, not just with respect to the Dreamers, but perhaps beyond as well.
Well, I think it's a big mistake, both factually and politically, to try to cast people who are concerned about illegal immigration and the crime that results as racist or white supremacist. I mean, I think that Northam's campaign ads are going to prove to be the equivalent of Hillary Clinton, you know, Clinton's basket of deplorables comment. I mean, people who have these very legitimate concerns about our immigration policy are, you know, don't want to be called racists or idiots. And I hope that they come out and express this in voting. We'll see what happens, but it strikes me as a huge mistake on Northam's part to dismiss these concerns. The Democrats, if they were smarter, would be doing the opposite and, you know, trying to get on the pro public safety, pro security bandwagon that has worked so well for Republicans.
Well, we will be watching this one closely, both the race and what flows from it. Jessica Vaughn, as I know will you, at the Center for Immigration Studies, I deeply appreciate the work you do there and that of your colleagues. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Abney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.